everybody, and welcome to the Internet Storm Center podcast. This is a special presentation of all the speeches that were given by the handlers at SANS 2009. This next presentation is by a handler by the name of Mark Hoffman. His presentation is entitled SOA and XML Security.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thanks for coming along. The last year and a half or so, I've been, well, to be honest, punished by having to work in a service-oriented architecture project. Like many security people, you know, about 3-4 years ago, you know, this XML stuff and service-oriented, or this SOA architecture stuff, which is all kind of foreign, weird stuff, you know. I went through the firewall and then ended up somewhere in the internal network, and it was someone else's problem to deal with. But the last year and a half, I haven't been able to dodge it, unfortunately. So I had to get stuck into a lot of the things that were going on. So basically, the presentation here is some of the things that, well, the pain that I've experienced. So I thought it was only fair that I share that pain with other people, including yourself. But hopefully it will actually do you some good. And there's a couple of things, especially on the XML side of things. As you're dealing with it, I mean, it's just a bunch of text, right? You know, how bad could a bunch of text be? Well, that's kind of the thing that we're going to go into as well. So what we're going to go through is very quickly what is SOA and the architecture, some security implications of what's going on there, what we can do about them, and then we're also going to move into XML, which is basically one of the engines within the SOA environment. And of course, we'll do a little bit of XML basics very quickly, I promise, and then we'll get finally into some of the security implications that I've come across and that other people have come across as well. So, what's SOA? Well, there's a nice definition up the board there, which I quite blatantly pinched off the people who are referenced there. So, a service-oriented architecture, a collection of services. Now, we're used to having applications. The service-oriented architecture environment, it is basically one-point solutions. No longer is there a big application that does absolutely everything. There are lots of little, well, applications that do just one specific task. So it's like, there's a cook that stands next to them, and the only thing that he can do is French fries. So if you ask the waitress something, she will take your order to the cook. If she gives the wrong order to the wrong cook, nothing will happen. Things will just break. Same thing in the service-oriented architecture environment. Okay, so you have to be very specific. So everything is specialized. Everything is a one-purpose thing. For the coders in the room, it's like a function in normal applications. You know, you call a specific function, you ask it to do something, and it will give you a result. The only difference is that rather than within a program, this is something that goes across your environment. So it can get quite messy. So they define the services. So for example, here it's got a currency conversion service. You know, I want to convert, I don't know, Zimbabwe dollars into Italian. You would have to connect to different applications. You might be connecting to, yeah, I don't know, a SAP server. If you wanted to do your, I don't know, customer management, you might be talking to a Siebel server. So different applications do have their specific particular functions. From a security perspective, it's every man for himself in those kinds of environment. Okay, everybody kind of has to look after themselves. The security is built around the application, but each application has to do its own thing. Yeah, it's not like the SAP server is going to share security information with the Siebel server or anything along those lines. You know, you might get authentication similar between the two. They might authenticate through an LDAP or Active Directory, so you can get sort of semblance of single sign-on and things like that, or pass-through authentication. So that's kind of cool, but by and large, you want to do one thing, you go here. You want to do something different, you go there. So that makes it fairly, I suppose, simple, but it also makes it complex. It makes it simple because you only have to deal with one vertical. You don't have to deal with the whole environment, which we'll see in a second. You only have to deal with that one particular stream to secure it. And, you know, with a bit of luck, someone else is looking after that one and someone else is looking after that particular application. It kind of makes it complex as well, just to make sure that we've got some good contradictions in there. It makes it complex as well because you can't necessarily apply your security consistently. So that's kind of the thing that we're dealing with at the moment. To externalize the application, typically what happens, you know, people put a firewall in, they put a front-end server into a DMZ, and then they still follow this kind of architecture. So that's the thing that we've been very used to over the last God knows how long. So a transaction typically, you know, you connect to the front end and then it goes down to the application. Follow the bouncing ball tonight, by the way. Okay, you follow the application down to the database, it gets the information, the application layer gives it back to the front end, etc. The reason I didn't put a front end on that one is because, well, you might only have a two-tier application, for example. Now, service-oriented architecture is a slightly messier picture. Okay, we'll go into the little bits and pieces in a couple of slides. So there's no longer that big application that does lots of things. There is this one specific function that does one particular job, and that's it. Yeah, if you want to find something in a database, you ask the get stuff from the database function or service. If you want to add something into a database, you call the put stuff into the database service. So there are no longer sort of these end-to-end connections. It's basically throwing the message somewhere, okay, and hoping that it gets picked up and something happens with it. This enterprise services bus. Do you remember those diagrams that you saw in it's quite a comical one, I suppose, where it's got, you know, servers on the outside and it's got a big cloud in the middle and it's got the phrase magic happens here. Do you remember those ones? You've probably all seen one of those. Okay, well, guess where it is? That is the magic happens here box. Okay, but I thought it'd be a bit rude if I'd put that one up there. So the enterprise services bus is kind of the engine that drives a lot of the SOE environments. In a typical SOE environment, there are some services that everybody relies on. You can't do without them. And typically, identity and access management is one of those services. There are other ones, and we'll go through them in a second. The diagram looks a little bit messier than the previous one, right? Well, that's a SOA environment. It is kind of a messy little thing. You are trying to reuse things, but by bolting them together, you are actually making life quite difficult for you. The good thing about them, though, is, of course, they're very flexible. If you want to add another one of these, well, you've got all of this infrastructure already doing stuff. Yeah? So adding on one of these is probably not such a big deal. So they do have their purposes in the computing environment. Now, guess what people do to externalize these SOA functions? Because there's always one CEO that says, hey, we've got these good applications in the back end. You know, we've been driving this one since 1970. That one's been going through since 1975. And, oh, well, we put those ones in last year. Wouldn't it be really great if we had all of this information available to our business partners or internet users? So what do people do? They whack a firewall in there. There you go, pretty flames. They whack a firewall in there, and that is it. Yeah. So now what happens is people from the internet, maybe using an application, maybe logging into something, they are still using that same infrastructure. Okay, those of you who aren't quite haven't got half the brain full from today's lessons and things like that, you're already starting to puzzle, hopefully, saying, well, hang on, are you trying to say that this application, for example, that's been lying around there for the last 15, 20 years, we're going to expose that to the internet? Yeah? Well, yes, you would be right. That's exactly what I'm saying. And that's exactly what happens. Okay? Government departments, large financial organizations, all kinds of retailers, manufacturers, you name it, they are starting to expose these internal services to the world using SOA. So hopefully that's already starting to make you cringe slightly. Because, of course, that mainframe application that they've been using for the last 20 years has been very well secured. Now, I'm an old mainframe guy, so I know that mainframes can be very secure, but they're not necessarily designed to be used by the general public. Those applications that are getting hit by maybe 10 or 20 internal users, well, how are they going to cope with the 4 or 5 million people that you might be throwing in there after all? So that's just a couple of the things that we're going to talk about. So we saw the transaction in the tiered architecture. So we'll do follow the bouncing ball environment here as well. Okay, so typically you have the different components there. So before we get there, so you've got the application or the portal. So the SOA environment, it does make it very easy to get interactions between disparate products. For example, if I was a car manufacturer, I have to ship cars to my dealers. Those dealers have to order those cars from me. Okay, that's kind of how it works. So what does the car dealership do right now? Well, they put their order into their finance system or their ordering system within their dealership. Then typically they print that out. They send it, fax it, email it over to the manufacturer. The manufacturer has someone that types that order into the ordering system within that particular organization, and hey presto, a car gets shipped to a dealership and someone gets paid. So that's the current process in a lot of these places. Now, with an SOA environment, what you could do is, well, we can get that interaction between the two applications going. So now you can create your order into your finance system. Magic happens here. Okay, and hey presto, the order ends up in the car manufacturer's ordering system, and hey presto, you get a car. So that's all kind of cool. And that's one of the things that SOA is very nice for. But there are different components that you need. So obviously you need the applications. Well, hopefully you might have already had that. Typically what you end up with is with identity and access management, because you are now throwing basically requests or to do something into this big magic cloud, and you hope that something happens with it. Yeah. So we're going to get a little bit confused about, well, where did this request really come from? Well, I don't know, because in an SOA environment, I have to be flexible, I have to be nice. So today it might only be coming from, well, one application. To tomorrow it might be coming from 10 applications, the day after 100. So, you know, things like that, the interaction between the application and where the requests are coming from can get quite confusing. So an identity and access management system is kind of nice, because then you have a central location where you can start asking, well, who the heck are you? So you have one location where you can get the identity from. Typically, they get that from an Active Directory or an LDAP server or whatever else you've got lying around. Now, that's where your first problem starts. One of our clients, a government agency, I started working there, and of course, I had to get clearance. So I went into the HR database, and I went into the clearance guys database, and the clearance guys did their magic, and they sent information over to the HR thing. Well, the problem was that when we did a data quality check on these different databases, the HR system had me 4 times. I was Matthew Hoffman, because someone thought my first name was Matthew. I was Mark Hoffman with double F, because, well, that's how you spell it, surely. Okay. I was Mark Hoffman, finally, with one F. Okay, so that was kind of good. And where's the fourth one? Well, that was Mark Kaufman, because someone typed it a little bit wrong. So I was in there 4 times. My clearance level on all of them, and I did pass, my clearance level on all of them was pending. This is after about a year that I'd been there. Yeah, well, if my clearance is pending, I'm not actually allowed to touch any systems that have any kind of classification. So what happens there? And that's where the identity and access management stuff comes into it, because then you centralize it, etc. But that's where your first problem is. Data quality, where are you going to get the information? Licensing is also going to be a challenge. You know, if you have, I don't know, 10,000 internal users, you pay X amount of money. You're going to now start putting your customer information in there as well with identity and access type controls. Well, that might be a couple of million. The vendors have tweaked onto that one, so you pay a bigger price for a couple of million than you do for the 10,000 or so. So, you know, things like that start to play in this environment as well. So the identity and access management environment is actually one of the most important components in a SOA environment. So that means you're going to have two, right, for redundancy. Some other things that you can bolt in there is policy things and the policy engines and business rules. So now you can get applications to not only check whether someone has an identity, but you can also say, well, if I'm sending a message from point A to point B, what do I do? Well, the policy engine might say, well, if you're doing that and the data is classified, then you have to encrypt it using this. Okay, so these kind of choices can be made in there. The business rules is more along the lines of, well, if it's an external user and they're trying to do this particular request, then that should be okay. So rather than actually doing it on roles, you are actually trying to authorize people to do it on request. Now, the one thing that I should probably say is that all of this is as flexible or as inflexible as you want it to be. All of the transactions can be any which way you want it to be. Okay? If, for example, this application here doesn't feel like doing an identity check, there's nothing there to force it. If it doesn't feel like checking whether a person is authorized to do a transaction, well, maybe it doesn't have to. And that's the one thing that I see in a lot of SOA environments is where people are implementing things, and especially from security folk. Now, we've been doing a good job of starting to help the business and enable the business to do things, right? That's actually a little bit our enemy in an SOA environment. In an SOA environment, if you let things run along for too long or too much, you will get things like, this application here is going to directly talk to that application there, and this application here is going to, well, maybe check a digital signature or verify a certificate or do some authentication stuff, etc. Rather than having it in the magic cloud, it gets done on that application. Now, if you're doing it that way, it's at both endpoints, what's your problem going to be? Well, your problem is going to be is that now you're going to have to do it in that application, you're going to have to do it in the next application, the next one that you bolt along. So all the advantages of having a SOA environment have gone away. So you need to build that security into the magic cloud. Now, how do you build it into that magic cloud? Well, that's what you guys have to decide. What are the rules going to be? So let's follow a transaction. So remember, in the normal tiered architecture environment, it's go to some sort of front end, go to the application, it goes to the database, and it gives me stuff back. All right? Well, we follow a red dot first. Typically, a user might log on to a portal of some sorts. When the portal receives the login request, it goes to the identity and access management system and says yay or nay. Now, there's your first choice of security people. Am I just going to ask whether they can log on, or am I going to ask the IAM, can this person log on, and can you please provide me with all the roles that they have within the organization? Okay, so we already have a choice to make there. Do we just authenticate, or do we authenticate and get stuff that we can use elsewhere? Well, the answer there is, it depends. One of our favorite answers in security. Okay. This application here, for example, application one, might be very capable of doing its own authorization. So once it gets information about the user, you know, and the roles, it can do everything else itself. And that's cool. Yeah? But application two, for example, it might not be able to do that. It needs to have its security externalized. So when you talk to application two, what actually happens is application two goes and asks the IAM, can this person do this? All right? So let's follow the bouncing ball for a second. We've logged on to the portal. We're now going to log on to application one. So we've asked the request, put something in the database. Okay? Application one isn't quite sure about everything, so it goes to the IAM and says, can this be done? Is it okay? All right. And it then provides the user finally with the information that they want. So there's now already a more convoluted path in that particular transaction. So if we're using an application, so for the example that I gave before, you know, I've got my own finance system, you've got your ordering system, we need to get the stuff across. You might be logging on to your own application in your own organization and sending this magical piece of paper called XML across to the other side. So now the transaction goes slightly a bit different. And don't get dizzy on this. It'll go off to the IAM saying, can I do this? And it ends up on the application that you're actually trying to call or the function that you're kind of trying to look at. And then finally, the application says, well, yep, I'll get the stuff from the database, and it gives it directly back to the application that called it in the first place. So that is just a different path again. Now, what I've just shown you there, those two transactions, that's not set in stone either. Okay? So if security guys like us don't start taking hold of how these transactions should be flowing across the organization, that could look like anything. And that gets very messy. And it's always harder at the end to fix things up than it is at the start to define what you want them to do. So, you know, this is all starting to sound a little bit hard. So why would we use this as a solo environment? Well, you know, people have a requirement to get information from different sources. You've got one bank taking over another bank. They've both got mainframes with customer records. Your choice is migrate stuff, or leave it exactly where it is and put some sort of front end into it that queries both sites. That's where SOA is very good. Interoperation, well, I've gave you the example there. You know, one application in the dealership, a different application at the manufacturer, get the information out. All cool. That's kind of nice. Information use, etc. We had a lot of customers doing the SOA stuff because they had information in their organization. They just could not put it together in a sensible manner that people could use. Okay, so they had the problem where they were being a very reactive organization to fraud type, have to phrase that carefully, yeah, to fraud within the organization. So by using a SOA environment, they were able to pull much more information from different sources, correlate it, and actually detect fraudulent activities. So that was a very good use of it. Legacy systems, well, you've paid for that mainframe, and you're using the mainframe. Taking things off the mainframe and putting it somewhere else is just hard. That's where SOA comes into handy as well. So it does have a good use. So there's lots of elements. I mean, there's typically the web services that you hit. There's thing called SOAP that makes the XML go from point A to point B. We've got, of course, XML, which we'll get to in a second. Typically, you have that identity access management system. Now, token and timestamp service, again, performs a particular function in that environment as well. How do I know that this transaction that's just arrived is valid? Well, the short answer is you don't. You just know that you received the request in a particular service, and all you know that you're supposed to do is take that request and answer it. How do you know where it came from? How do you know it wasn't launched, it wasn't asked 2 days ago? How do I know that it was only a few seconds ago? Well, the answer is, again, you don't. But that's where a token system comes, or a timestamp system comes into play. You can start timestamping transactions and then throw them away if they've been around for too long, etc. So you've got the policy and the business rules. We talked about that. So from a security perspective, in a traditional environment, we had firm boundaries. You had this application, and that's where we lived. Well understood, controlled path through it. But in the SOA environment, there's no more boundaries. Things can come from anywhere and go anywhere and end up anywhere. So here we go. What are the challenges? Well, confidentiality. We are basically sending a plain text file from point A to point B. That can't be good for confidentiality. All right, so that's problem number one. Integrity, we just mentioned that. things can come from anywhere. This application here, for example, could actually call a service on that particular device. Well, if I'm a nasty bugger over here, how does this application know that it came from him and not from me? How do we know that any one of these services hasn't mucked around with that particular transaction? Well, the answer again is you don't. So the integrity of your information becomes a problem as well. Accountability. This is kind of a fun one. Typically what happens, right? You log on to a portal. What do you log on with? Well, you log on with Mark and a password, Bob. So the portal knows who I am. The portal now issues a request for a particular application. Now, who issues that request? Does Mark issue that request, or does the portal issue a request? Again, that's going to be the security guy's decision. What did you decide to do? Okay, well, if you don't decide anything, I can tell you the answer is going to be the easy one, which is that the portal does the request. So the portal is now doing the request to a specific application. Okay, what happens in that, maybe that particular application there? It does a database call. Now, which user is going to do that database call? Is it going to be Mark? No. Is it going to be the portal? No. It's just going to be some generic user ID that's going to be used by that service or by that application, get the information out of the database. So now we have a user ID that logs on. That's cool. We've got accountability there. We've got a magical transaction made by a portal which may or may not be able to be linked back to the user. That's kind of cool. We have a database request by a database user who may or may not be able to be correlated back to the portal user, which was correlated back to the back-end user. Okay, maybe. Now, there are lots of web services. Yeah, lots of web services that connect to the database. So what privileges does that database user have? You don't need to guess, do you? Okay, it's going to have anything because it might need to add things into the database or take things out. So again, so now we have a privileged generic user that's doing everything. Now all of those things are design choices that someone has to make. And if they're not made at the start, getting them fixed at the end is going to be pretty much impossible. Okay, that's one of the big lessons I learned. There's probably about three big projects that we stopped in that manner by saying, well, guys, you just can't do that. It's just not the same way of doing things. So what does your original firewall do for an SOA environment? Well, that's an easy answer, nothing. Okay, it's a HTTP request with a bit of text at the back. So unless it happens to be XML aware, and there are some that are coming onto the market that know what XML at least looks like, it's not going to do anything. HTTP request just goes straight through. Antivirus, well, your antivirus is on your email. This is not email. The antivirus might be on your web browsing, but, you know, this is not something that actually goes past your web proxies and things like that. Again, so that's not really doing anything for us. Intrusion detection prevention, well, again, unless they're XML aware, they're still not going to do anything. Your logging, well, we just talked about that. Okay, here are all these users that may or may not relate to your SOA request. So how would we fix that? Well, typically what you end up doing is you end up either passing that original user ID along as part of the request, or you have some sort of transaction identifier, so you don't have to go sitting there saying, well, this transaction was at 736, this transaction here was at 736.01, so that's probably the same transaction as this data call to delete the database, which was at, you know, 736.10. So that's where your logging is going to go. So it can be get quite nasty. It's not all lost, though. You can do things, but you can encrypt it. You can say, well, we need to encrypt all the transactions between the different endpoints. That's fine. You can actually encrypt XML elements, because what's quite common is that in an XML document, you have elements that only apply for a specific application. So let's say you have to go to four applications to fulfill or services to fulfill your request. You will only send one page, but only certain bits of that page apply to each application. So you can encrypt all of those. You can encrypt them with different signatures and things, or different certificates, etc. So only the right application can decrypt the right bit, and all that kind of stuff you can do. Digital signatures, yep. Availability, well, that's basically your resource management and validation. We'll go into that when we go into XML. Your accountability, now your logging. You can do generate tokens, so you, it's similar to what Kerberos does and what Windows does. You know, it's generate a token saying, well, this is a valid user, these are the things that they can do. How about you just pass that along with the request? So now the back-end applications only have to check whether the token is valid or not. This token is valid? Yep, therefore I should process this request. But again, that token comes out of the Magic Cloud. So all of these things that I've got up there are actually choices that someone has to make in the organization. Yeah? Who makes them? Well, if I quickly go back to this one, that is typically done by developers. That's typically done by, well, possibly developers as well. Hey, look, that's done by developers as well. That they've got nothing to do with, because that might be an external application. Oh, look here, security guys, we get to talk about this bit. We might get a little bit of input here. We might get a little bit of input here. Yeah? But someone needs to define the rules. For example, would it be acceptable to have the portal do an SSL connection to application one directly and deliver the XML request directly to that application? Well, you would say, yeah, because we can do mutual authentication. That's cool. We know who's talking to whom. Yeah? But now you have to do that on each of the applications. So you don't get the advantage of having this magic cloud that has common functionality servicing your requests. So that's an important choice to make as well. So there is all these choices that someone has to make. Yeah? What encryption are we going to use? You know, is AES okay? If I decide to encrypt my elements in the XML, what am I going to use? Am I going to use DES? Am I going to use AES? Am I going to use, I don't know, pencil and paper? These are choices that someone has to make. So the most important one is security as a forethought. You know, you have to plan these things at the start. You can't come into the back. Now, when you start putting your security architecture together for a SOA environment, you have to be flexible. You have to cater for the applications or services that can only use their internal authorization. How are you going to provision them with information? How are you going to give that information to them? You might have applications that can't make any choices, security choices internally. They have to go and ask someone. How are you going to deal with those? All right, so you will have the different scenarios in your environment. For example, the Siebel product, one of the main products, it will only use its own internal authorization. It can authenticate somewhere else, but it can't make any authorization decisions. It can make some business rule choices. So this is where, for example, the you're an external user. I don't know who you are. Therefore, you can only do these things. Those business rules, it can have some of those rules internally, but only a couple. Yeah? So if you go beyond that, well, where are you going to put it? Well, you're going to have to put it somewhere in the Magic Cloud. So all of these things are design choices that someone has to make. So define your rules for the transactions. How are you going to do the messaging? Are you going to use the ESB bus? Are you going to allow people to do direct connections to between the applications? Are you going to, I don't know, use SOAP? Are you going to use SAML? So these are the things we're going to talk about in a second. Yeah, which version are you going to use? What assertions are you going to make? How are you going to do the authentication? Are you going to blindly trust this transaction that comes at the service and say, well, hey, it's got a valid certificate, so it must be okay? Or are you actually going to, check the chain? So there's all these different things that you have to think about. The authentication, when to authenticate and where? You can authenticate at the portal. You can authenticate when someone calls the service. You can authenticate when you're trying to do a specific transaction. So there's different points where you can authenticate. Someone has to make a decision about where that happens. Same thing with the authorization and logging. Again, how much are you going to do? In a SOA environment, it's not uncommon to actually start putting centralized logging. If you're doing a SOA environment or a SOA deployment in your environment, then I reckon if you can't get budget for things like centralized logging and events management through the business as well, you're not trying hard enough. It should be a fairly easy choice because you just have to point out, say, hey, look, if there is some sort of fraudulent transaction, we haven't got a snowball's chance of actually trying to figure out where that came from. The time on one of the servers only has to be out by a couple of seconds and our whole trail just disappears. So they're good arguments for your budgets. Define where the security happens and stick to it. I've seen that a few times as well. We had one client, we had a great design, at least we thought so. It fitted all the applications and things like that. And then one of the projects came up with, if we do it that way, we're going to have to pay an extra $50,000. We don't have that in the budget. Sorry, we're not doing it. Okay? So once you make these choices, you have to stick to it. And we were able to tell them, say, look, buddy, how about you suck it in somewhere else and just pay your $50,000 and get it done. So we were lucky. But if you don't set out these rules beforehand, you can't win. So with XML, there's different bits and pieces that make SOA environments work. So you've got the XML translation sheets and things like that. We'll go through them quickly. Where are they used? Well, kind of all over the place. So the XML is usually used to transfer information. They've got SOAP to have wrap around it. You've got the SAML assertions that make things happen and tell you security information. You've got your translation sheets, which maybe take an XML sheet and maybe put it into MQ series or something like that, an MQ series request, because you've got the mainframe hanging around. You've paid for MQ series. You might as well use it. Okay. XSD, so schema, so validation of things. These are kind of things that happen in the cloud as well. You've got your WSDLs, which we're going to talk about in a second as well, but this is how you present the services that you do to the rest of the planet. So all of these things are used somewhere. So XML, extensible markup language, it's self-describing, so you can actually put in anything there in there that you want. It doesn't use tags like HTML where, you know, bracket P, bracket means paragraph. If you want to describe a piece of information, you can call it anything that you want. You can call it jug. The jug element, okay, or in this case I've got the name element here. It describes it. Well, there's the first name, here's the value, we're closing the value, here's the middle name, there is no middle name, last name, etc. So it's self-describing. You should be able to pick up a piece of XML and actually understand what it means. Now, one important thing to remember, XML actually itself doesn't do anything. For XML to do something, you actually do need an application of some sort. Something needs to take that XML and then start doing something with it. So it is purely there to describe information and use that information somewhere. So in config files, for example, we're starting to see XML a lot. And of course, to get that information from one place to another place. So here's a little example. Now, let's put our little hacker hats on for a couple of seconds and see if we can find the interesting bits of information in this piece of XML. So, whoops, we've got the name there. Okay, so the product that's being sold, Bedpans, the name of the customer, and of course, the information that we actually want, which is the credit card information. And yes, this is something that we pulled off a network that was going from point A to point B. Okay, so just in clear, being transmitted across the network. So a fail. Yeah, not a good thing. So the XML will show you exactly what's inside of it and you will find confidential information in there. The schemas are used to actually validate information. So a schema, XML schema, describes what the information should look like. That there doesn't really tell you anything. It doesn't tell you that the bedpans can be 50 characters, that you can have up to 999 bedpans that you can buy in one go. That's where the schema comes into it. The schema defines, well, how many, how big, what kind of field it is. You've got the different values of strings and integers, etc. You can put patterns in there, so you can actually, in a schema, describe very closely what the information in the XML data should look like. So that's kind of cool, because now you can start validating the XML that you receive against the schema. If it doesn't match, you throw it out. So, hey, we like that as security people, because now there's less chance of people mucking around with that XML, because we have something that we need to validate. However, what do you need to protect most? The schema. Yeah, because that's what defines the data. Or that's what defines the data that's being accepted by the application. So the stylesheet language just translates between XML and something else. So there's an example there, translation to HTML, but you can do MQ series, you can do all kinds of transactions that you can translate from your XML. So that's kind of cool. Good for dynamic web pages. This is the stuff that happens inside AJAX transactions. Yeah. So this kind of stuff gets passed backwards and forwards and gets presented to you. Because throwing a piece of XML across the wire doesn't really do much, it needs to get from point A to point B, so that's where SOAP comes into it. So SOAP, the easy way to look at it is, the clue is in that word there, it is an envelope. So the XML is your piece of paper, SOAP is the envelope you put it into, you lick it, you send it off, and off it goes. The WSDL's and the UDDI. The WSDL is there to describe the services that are available. So this is something that's published on the internet if you're taking transactions across the internet. So you can pull these down. So Google has them for the search engine. Amazon has them for a lot of their ordering systems, etc. And it will give you a document that's quite large that will describe exactly what should the XML look like if you were doing a transaction with us. So that's kind of cool, because you can now start looking through that and say, hey, what are these guys doing? This is the one that I pulled off of the WIGIS, what is it, Wisconsin Justice Information Sharing website. Okay. In that piece of WSDL, it describes exactly what they do and accept on that particular transaction across the internet. Now, they've actually got some security controls in place, which is kind of cool. They make you log in with a user ID and password. Beautiful. They actually allow you to, or that you have to get a certificate from them, so obviously they're doing some XML signing and things like that. But again, all the information on how they secured it, they actually published on the internet through one of the other providers as a case study. So the WSDL documents are kind of there. Now, if you're not sure what services a particular organization is providing, well, that's where the UDDI comes into it, because basically that's the yellow pages of all the services that that organization provides, so the SOA services. SAML, you put use for authentication and other attributes into the actual documents. We'll see more of that in a second. No, we won't. Where is my page gone? Ah, here we go. All right, so this is what a piece of SAML looks like. It's an assertion. You can put things like digital signatures in there. So you've signed a component of the XML. This is where the digital signature goes. If that component of the XML changes, the digital signature doesn't match. So now you know that, you know, the message has been mucked around with. So that's one of the things that you can do to get that integrity going. Here we go. There's a couple of other things that are kind of cool in there. You can put conditions in SAML assertions as well, so you can basically say this transaction is not valid before that or after that. The only real problem with that is, of course, if I intercept this transaction, I can change those values and, hey presto, the transaction is suddenly valid again. So that's something that you have to keep in mind as well. All right, so these are all the different things that you can do with SAML assertions. There's also attributes, etc., in there, but I'll have to scream along a little bit, because otherwise Pedro will beat me up. A lot of the problems with XML especially are the same as we have in normal web applications. Okay, parameter tampering, SQL injection. Well, the only difference is really that, well, you have to muck around with a piece of XML using, I don't know, notepad. So that's pretty much a big change, okay? Because now we can't type it in our browser anymore. We have to, edit it. So what are some of these things? Well, parameter tampering. We saw the XML has it's self-describing. So, for example, if we have an element called name, well, what happens if I throw this at the application and say names? What's it going to do? Well, our applications, just like anything else, or the services, I should say, they might throw an error of some sorts. Yeah? If I have a field of first name that's only supposed to be 20 characters, what happens if I throw, 5,000 characters in there? Okay. So you can play around with all of these parameters. So you can change the soap parameters, you can change the envelope, you can do the not before, etc. You can add things into it. Now, how are we going to stop people mucking around with parameters? I've already gave you the answer, so this should be an easy one for you. Using that schema validation. If you specify this is what the XML should look like, and if it doesn't, I don't want it, then you will stop a lot of these things as well. What if you put small values in there? Yeah, some XML transactions will actually do calculations. Yeah. Well, divide by zero. Let's see what happens if I do that. What happens if we, multiply 20 million by, 500 gazillion? Let's see the application deal with that, see what it does. And a lot of the times, the applications will crumble because they were never meant to deal with that kind of thing. Yeah? Your mainframe application was a very structured, very well-coded thing. The interface into that particular application was very well designed. It was specific. But now you're opening it up with something flexible and people can throw anything they like at it. One thing that you can do in XML as well is you can actually route it. Yeah? To get it through that magical cloud, you can actually specify in the XML how it should travel. Remember source routing problems? Well, we've kind of reinvented the same thing. Just one of the other presentations, in fact, in the handler thing, we're kind of repeating some of our mistakes. So typically, yeah, you might put in there, I'm going to send this XML, and I'm going to send it via here. Now, what happens if I manage to put that in there? Now I'm sending the transaction to me first, where I can do anything I want to it, and then send it through. So you can actually redirect a piece of XML in your environment. How do we stop that? Well, the only real way is to digitally sign that particular element. Otherwise, you won't know that it's been changed. So things like that, you can reroute the XML. That's kind of cool to do. Credentials, of course, you can be anything because it doesn't necessarily know that it's supposed to be you. So again, you can be anyone. You can be Mrs. Chan if you wanted to. So you have to enforce your authentication. Again, where are you going to do that? Is the end application going to accept the authentication, or is someone in the magical cloud going to say, that dude's okay, all right? And you know that I've said it's okay because here's the SAML assertion that says he's fine. And so now the application only has to check the SAML assertion. Is the SAML assertion there? Yes. Is it valid? Yes. Cool. I'll process it. Otherwise, it would have to make all of those design those choices itself. The Wisdom exposure, they're auto-generated. So they're there to advertise things. So they're there to actually tell people about things. So the more you publish, the more information hackers will have. Denial of services. Here's your poor little application, and it's designed to grab a 4 megabyte XML file, and you give it a 4 gigabyte XML file. Who's going to squeal? That application is not going to like it. The same thing with lots of transactions. Send 1,000 documents at a SOA service, and it is most likely going to die. So things like that you have to control as well. So you have to identify where they go. A couple more, and then I'm going. Yeah? He's kicking me off. Recursive payloads. It's really easy to embed items within items in items, and you can see what happens there. Transactions are happily going along, and suddenly it has to do with one of these. Hey, presto, I'm now going to spend forever trying to complete this particular transaction. SQL injection, same sort of deal. This is what a normal transaction looks like. Okay? Throwing at a little bit of an invalid response, I get the error messages. Okay? And from that error message, I can actually forge a normal SQL request that we all know and love and get all the information in my request. So again, these are the kind of things that keep on going. In the XML, you'll see a lot of external references to, for example, existing schemas. Now, what if someone takes over one of those domains? Now I'm taking their schemas and not the one that I was intending. So you can actually, almost like a DNS cache poisoning type of attack, but at a schema level. Okay? Schemas, again, we talked about that. Once you can manipulate that schema of how it looks like and how the XML should look, you can basically change it into anything you like. Malicious code, well, it doesn't go through the AV engine, so attaching a Trojan, for example, to an interface with a document management system. Here's a piece of XML with the metadata. It has the file attached. Now, what you're supposed to do with this is put the metadata into the document management system, take the file, put it into the document management system for people to use. Where's the antivirus gone? Well, you can have that magical cloud say, hey, this is something that's going to document management system. What I'm supposed to do is take that attachment, throw it over to the AV engine, okay, and then wait for a response that says, yep, that's cool to go in. There you go. Just made it. Thanks. So basically, you just have to remember that in an SOA environment, you have to make the design choices at the start. If you don't, you are going to get into trouble. You are going to get projects that will do their own thing. And unfortunately, like I said, from security, we are there to enable the business, but this is one case where we might have to be tough and say, no, you are not doing that. You are doing it this way. Okay? These are the reasons why this is how your environment works. Now, I know this was very, very quickly. If there's any questions, I'll be around for the next few days anyway, so feel free to tag me along. There's probably another 2-3 hours that I can talk on this on different bits and pieces. So, but that was just a very quick overview of SOA and XML. So thank you very much.